I'm Hélène Lindemore. I just want to add a few words to Jan's introductory remarks. I have one bad news and one good news. I'm going to start with the bad news. Jem Srowiecki can unfortunately not be with us today, so I apologize for his absence. He is very sorry, but he was kept in New York by personal reasons. So the good news is we have two wonderful people to replace him, Hélène Rio and Emile Servan-Schreiber. Hélène Rio is a PhD student in strategy at the Haute École de Commerce of Paris School of Management, and she is the translator in French of Jem Srowiecki's book, The Wisdom of Crowds, La Sagesse des Foules en Français. And so she's going to present the book and hopefully give us a sense of what Srowiecki would have said. And Emile Servan-Schreiber is the co-founder, president, and chief executive officer of News Future, which is the leading firm in information markets in France. And so he's going to explain to us how they work and how you can apply the collective wisdom logic to the world of firms. So I think we should proceed with our first speaker, so Hélène Rio.
So I'm here to present James's book. Unfortunately, as Hélène said, he couldn't be here. So I do my best to replace him. And I think Emile Servan-Schreiber will help me very much in that. Because I think part of the book, The Wisdom of Crowds, which was a very famous book all over the world, is devoted to defending prediction markets. So as Emile has a firm about this topic, I will take 15 minutes to present James's book, and then Emile will present you his business. He's a good friend of James, and they have often presented this kind of presentations. If you will, maybe I could sit. It will be... I will first go on into a brief presentation of James's initial assumption concerning the wisdom of crowds. I would define it using the book as a more of an assumption than a definition. He says that according to him, groups organized or not in organized or not means they can be in a traffic jam where it's not organized, or in an organization where we suppose multinationals are organized. Does it work? Can you hear me? Okay. Organized crowds. All these type of crowds have the capacity to act in a collective way to take decisions and solve problems, even if individuals within these groups are not aware of this ability to act together. I first want to point out, after this brief definition, how influential this book was. It uses a cross-disciplinary approach using economy, sociology, psychology, as well as animals' worlds. It's very much based not on theory, but on examples. James, being a journalist, he uses these kind of examples to make his point. So it was really a bestseller in the US. It was quoted so many times in The Economist year 2007. And it was also translated in many countries and in France too. So, what his point is to try to contradict the very strong idea before he wrote the book that the crowd is sort of a debraining machine that authors such as Francis Galton, Charles Mackay, and Gustave Le Bon were very keen on showing that as soon as people are getting together, they have no control over their reactions. And Charles Mackay, who was a Scottish journalist, wrote a book called Madness of Crowd in 1841, where he tried to show that people behaved as herds and cattle as soon as they were gathered. So did Gustave Le Bon, using popular juries to show that the verdict which were reached would not have been supported by one single jury, one single person in the jury. So the question to James is there something such as collective intelligence or collective wisdom? We'll see later if there is a difference or what is the difference between wisdom and intelligence. But to James, I think it's about the same. To James, people are not dumber if they act and think collectively. On the contrary, they are more clever. Only depends on a certain setting. So James Sorosky believes in collective decision-making as the basis of democracy and market economy. And I think the key point of his book is the importance of market as a decision-making process, but also as a system. So I take a few examples, which are in James's book, to show the point. First, the idea of crowdsourcing can be used, he illustrated at least, with two main examples, which are a TV show, which you may have known, called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Maybe you've seen it. And he said that at a point in the game, the person who's playing has a choice between placing a call to any expert whom he knows, or poll the studio audience. And a study was made, and 65% of the answer to the question were right when asking the experts, whereas 91% of the answers were right when asking the crowd. So he thinks it's better to poll the crowd, even though these people were idle people in the middle of the afternoon watching what we could call a silly game on TV. So the other example might be a more scientific one. He says that the SRAS epidemic in Hong Kong was solved within a month through a scientific collaboration, and it was unheard of. And he uses Robert K. Merton's quote, saying that in science, private property is created by giving its substance away. And the whole scientific community might be an example of this crowdsourcing and sharing of data in a sort of decentralized way, because all scholars are very independent. So another example of this, well, we could say that this uses group dynamics, which was illustrated by psychologists during the 20s and from the 1920s to the 1950s. Only to have this intelligence of crowd, James wants to point out that you need a good balance and you need to organize and coordinate, which means his examples for this are PageRank, an algorithm by Google, of course, to show quotes, and as well as prediction markets. But I think Emil will go more into this. So you need good signals and good interpreters, which imply a clever system to get in. And he uses the example of animals. For example, the wisdom of the hive and how bees dance to show what their sources were. Scouts can tell the hive where to go to get to survive. Of course, he is very aware that, and I will not go too much into it, but there are problems of cognition, of cooperation, and coordination within groups, as well as there are problems for experts. Another example, however, of this crowded intelligence is the firm, a topic I know quite well, since management is the topic I study. So he uses a case study, which is very much in favor now in management, since the firm is doing very well, which is called the Zara case study, which is maybe you know, it makes fashionable clothes. So it's a multinational, initially based in Galicia, where their main specificity is that they treat fashion, we could say, as dairy products. It has to be fresh. So you have supplies twice a week in the 600 shops. I think it's more now, 600 shops of Zara all around the world. And they have 300 suppliers in Spain, near their 300,000 square meters warehouse, where their information systems classifies everything. So that allows them to have no stocks and no sales, since the clothes that are supplied in the shops are always at the top of fashion, of course. And this can be done because employees carry information from the bottom to the top of the firm. And this can be opposed to old models such as the ones who were quoted by Peterson Waterman when they wrote another management bestseller in 1982, The Price of Excellence. Too much hierarchy, not really democratic decision-making, CEOs treated as heroes who could do everything, means a lot of mistakes. And stock options may not be the solution to this, since especially when they are distributed only to the top management. So this is the idea of a decentralized firm and rather democratic to James. Another and the most important example being markets, and go on to this. Market judgment is the less subject to influence to James, so therefore it's the most democratic, because people in that system can act independently and in an autonomous way. But the problem is, of course, that they always bet on the future. So he takes two examples of bubbles and crashes. The bowling bubble in the 1950s, because people were trying to make short-term prediction in something which was kind of a long-term market. And they thought that everybody would go bowling like 2 hours a day, which was very unrealistic. So that's how a bubble is created. And another example is the one of LTCM, Long-Term Capital Management, a fund founded in New York by Myron Schultz and Robert Merton, which failed desperately. It lost $5 billion in 2 months and had to be rescued by a pool of bankers from Wall Street. And, of course, these great economists and experts wanted to outbet the market. And James says that's the reason why they were actually defeated by the market. And finally, the last of James's example is democracy and public choice. To him, it's the basis of democracy and the school of public choice, which influenced him very much, is quoted here, is this ability to have people trust each other, and that can be done only if their own ID is respected. So he thinks, for example, if we want people to pay taxes, because there was a big problem of tax evasion, there still is, but it was a big issue, at least in the 1990s. If we don't want to be go-go's, we need to know three things, as Axelrod pointed out, three kinds of trust. Trust your neighbor, trust the government, which uses your money for education, peace, justice, and I guess security. And third kind of trust, ability to punish law enforcers. So that's the last example. And I go on to the main problems to be solved, according to James. They are a cognition problem for the crowd to be intelligent, coordination and cooperation. What does it mean? Well, cognition means the question is, who will win the Super Bowl next time? So you need, for this, to solve this cognitive problem, to have a market judgment, according to James. And the market must be well organized, of course. So then the other problem the crowds have to solve to prove themselves wise and intelligent is coordination. For example, how to buy and sell a product, how to walk the streets in a very crowded city. That's coordination problem. Last problem is cooperation problem. That means how to work together, pay your taxes, agree on wages, fairness, do something about environmental issues, for example. So, of course, they can be combined in more or less complex situations. And I have to admit that personally, in many cases, the case studies quoted by James, it's not really clear what type of problems are they are. They seem to be kind of mixed together. And I think that would be a very interesting issue to go much more into. So the solution to James be successful and manage cognition, coordination, and cooperation issues is diversity of crowds, diversity of opinion, independence. You must be able to go for what you think, even though you're alone to think this. And then you need a process of decentralization so people can specialize and draw from local knowledge, which is they personally know and no one else can. And the last thing is a mechanism of aggregation, a mechanism to turn private judgments into a collective decision. So the main thing one has to be careful with is consensus from the onset. It has to be reached after a debate. And James has two examples of failures, which I want to finish with, which is the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy, which later, Arthur Schlesinger, a historian, said that in the reunions before the decision-making, during the decision-making process, there was what he called an atmosphere of assumed consensus. And that means that the group was too homogeneous, too centralized, too imitative, and too emotional, too, because they had this feeling of belonging together. The opposite way, reason for failure, is the crowd or the group too divided, and that's the U.S. intelligence community in 201 during September 11, and the attack could not be prevented because information was not shared. And what James suggests is that the DARPA could have adopted the policy analysis market. And as you may know, it's been a bit controversial in 2003. And finally, it was not this market for analysis was, for moral reasons, not voted in Congress. So that's where I leave you to Emil before we let you ask some questions.
Hello, my name is Emil Servant-Schreiber. As Hélène said earlier, I'm the founder of News Futures. I'm also a cognitive psychologist. I studied with Herb Simon at Carnegie Mellon in the 90s. And my fascination with collective intelligence comes from a fascination with the workings of the mind itself. I think it's important when we talk about collective intelligence that we remember there is no intelligence that is not collective, in the sense that the brain itself is the collective effort of 10 billion little things that are not themselves very smart individually. So there is no intelligence that is not collective. I'm going to be talking about prediction markets. Prediction markets are one application of collective intelligence that are truly starting to make an impact in the business world and also in the media. I think it's very interesting that the idea of collective intelligence is not something that's just in the labs, but something that's actually making a real difference every day now. In the U.S., it's very striking. There's not one week that passes without 10 articles about prediction markets, about the election, for example, or about their applications in business. So we'll talk about that. Very quickly, for those who don't know what a prediction market is, this is an example. Interestingly, this is an example from last March, or actually the end of March. This is the stock for Obama to win the Democratic nomination. And this is a stock that you see the stock they're trading from March 2006 to March 2007 to March 2008. And the stock is going to be valued at $1 if Obama gets the nomination, and today he's apparently very close to that, or it's going to be worth zero if he doesn't. Okay, so in the meantime, the trading price, and you have people buying and selling this just like they would buy or sell, the stock of Boeing or Amazon or whatever, the stock price, which was at the end of March 81, is exactly calibrated to mean the percentage chance that the event happens in the future. Okay, and we'll see data that shows that this calibration is very, very fine. So the other interesting thing here is that, as you see, at the end of March, Obama was already being given, actually at the beginning of March, you can see Obama was given as the winner by the collective intelligence of the traders, even though the media, if you just read the paper, you have the impression that Clinton still had a chance for a long time. Actually, she had one chance in five, actually, but very small chance. It wasn't really a very close race, and people collectively knew that, even though the media, your major information source, has a bias to report something entirely different, which is a horse race, right? So that's why a lot of people now are turning to prediction markets to really know what's going on rather than reading the New York Times. Right? Not to say anything bad about the American press, which is way better than the French press. So this is an example of calibration of the price being a true reflection of the probability of events in the future. This is an example from a study we made with Justin Wolfers at Wharton, comparing real money and play money markets, but also looking at with 2,000 sports fans trading on sports games, basically football games, more than 200 football games over 6 months. And every time we would look at the price of the stock for who's going to be the winner right before the game, and so we can assess, is the market well calibrated. And you see here on the x-axis the trading price before the game, and on the y-axis the actual observed frequency of the winners. And so if it falls on the diagonal, it means the price really is a good indicator of the probability. And as you see, it works quite well, whether it's real money or play money, actually. And that's very important. There are many other different kinds of motivations for people in the world than just money. And the economists who study these things tend to forget that a little bit. This is also an example of calibration, but this time in a completely different set of events, which is business events. This is the result of a study made at Google over a couple years on more than 150 different kinds of events of, are we going to be able to deliver this product on time? Are we going to meet the deadline? How many bugs are we going to find in this particular tool? Is it going to be a success? All kinds of interesting business events within Google. And as you see, the purple line, which is the data set of the prices, actually follows diagonal quite closely as well. And a final example of calibration is within the political arena. The Iowa Electronic Markets, operated from the Iowa Business School, with a very small sample of people and very small stakes of money, has been very successful for the last at least almost 20 years now. Of data. This is data for 50 elections, 239 different political stocks, showing that the actual price really predicts the vote share. Not the probability of victory so much here as the vote share itself. So when the price says, 56 cents on the dollar, it really means that the candidate is going to get very close to 56% of the vote. Okay, so you can use these things, these markets, as not only to predict probability for events in the future, but also to predict actual numbers that you can compare to the real numbers. Just to give you a data point on this, as it says here, for example, I can't see. The little red squares. The red squares are the presidential elections. And they're extremely well calibrated. The average error for the presidential election predictions with the Iowa market has been 1.33%. And that's compared to almost 6% for the average of polls. So the market is really doing a much better job than the polls are. That's true in the US. It's not so much true in Europe, where the polls are much better than in the US. In the US, they have different problems with polls. Exactly. They don't apply these weird Coca-Cola formulas to them. But still, you know, yes, I mean, you can have polls that are at least as good or better than markets. That's for sure. And that's especially true in Europe, where we find that very much. But as a reader of news in the US, you're inundated by polls from CNN, Gallup, whatever. Who should you turn to? That's the question. Practically, who should you turn to get your real information? And that's not the CNN poll or the Gallup poll. That's the prediction market. So what we find, and I'm not going to go into too much detail because we really don't have much time, but what we find, and we and others, of course, is that markets, whenever we compare them to anything else, any other way of making predictions about the future, are really the best alternative. So they are better than asking individual experts. And we have business people telling us, you know, your solution is so much better than asking a consultant. You know, because why? Because the individual experts offer no diversity and they offer a lot of biases. Right? They are better than opinion polls, as we saw, partly because opinion polls, when they are not corrected, really don't offer any reward for expertise of individual opinions, and they don't penalize the fools, those who answer without having any idea, and they don't ponderate the knowledgeable people. They don't give them more of a voice than the people who really don't know anything. And finally, they're better than official company forecast within firms, and that's really the easy part, because those things are just worthless. It's completely political. Nobody inside a firm usually wants to really know the truth. They just want to set targets. You know, so it's actually very interesting, very easy to beat the official company forecast. So why does it work? And you'll hear a lot later from especially Scott Page about the role of diversity. And I want to salute his book here, a fantastic book. The Difference, not yet translated in French. We finally succeeded 4 years after the fact in translating this in French and publishing it. Hopefully we can do the same for Scott's book at some point. But the idea of diversity is one component of why prediction markets work. So everybody has, everybody contributes biased knowledge. So knowledge plus bias. The knowledge will add up, and the biases will basically cancel each other if you have enough people, enough diversity, right? The other reason it works, prediction markets, is that it rewards people for giving the signal, giving their information in a timely manner and in an independent manner, in a truthful manner, right? When you answer a poll, there's no incentive for you to say the truth. And in fact, that's been a big problem in assessing people's resistance to voting for a black candidate in the US, for example. People will not explicitly answer that they won't vote for a black guy. Okay, they will find other answers. Same thing in France, when you ask people, you know, about the extreme right. The extreme right candidates have been very, very difficult to assess in polls in France because people won't answer truthfully their preference for the extreme right. Okay. In a prediction market, if you think the extreme right guy is going to win the election, you better go and buy the stock right now. And as you do so, you send the signal to the market for everybody to see. So there's timely and truthful revelation. And also it encourages contrarian opinions, which is the difference of the inverse of consensus. There is no reward for you for just agreeing with everybody. There's reward for you for relying on your own independent information in order to beat everybody. Okay, so it's really creates a dialogue based on confrontation and ponderating the truth and getting all the information out. And the third reason it works is not often revealed. But this is, as a psychologist, it's very important to me, is that when you put people in a betting situation, you change the operating system of the brain. You basically activate areas of the brain that are not activated otherwise by contemplating possible rewards or loss. And this is an fMRI image of the brain looking at the possibility of reward or loss in a betting situation. And those areas are activated specifically by the fact that you're betting, that you're considering that you could be wrong or you could be right. Okay, so as you do so, as you put people in the brain in a special betting situation like this, you sort of feel like Phileas Fogg in Around the World in 80 Days. It says, you know, when you actually consider a bet, you take that very seriously. You know, there's nothing so serious as a wager, right? And that's true for Englishmen and for everybody else. And you sort of feel that, you know, you take even a gentleman's bet with a friend of yours. You know, you say something and he says, oh, really, you want to bet on that? And suddenly your brain shifts, right? You're sort of taken aback, and that's because your operating system changes. So prediction markets have been recognized now heavily by the press. As I said, there's not a week that goes by now without at least 10 or 15 articles about prediction markets in all kinds of context in the U.S., okay? In Europe, it's still very sluggish. People are not so aware of these things. But as you can see, this is the cream of the international media. And the recognition by The Economist is especially interesting there. That there's no better way of looking at the future than looking at the prediction market. But more interestingly, seducing a journalist is one thing. And that's pretty easy, but seducing a CEO, actually, that's not so difficult either. Seducing a middle manager, now that's a real problem. Okay, maybe we'll talk about that. But interestingly, as you can see through the years, I mean, there's increasing acceptance. I wouldn't say incredible acceptance, but increasing acceptance by leading firms, the best of the best, to try these things, to see how they can be applied within their organizations to basically let information flow in a more fluid manner within companies and to make and to seek the truth in a different way. The main business applications are the following. There's basically four. You know, you can forecast KPI, key performance indicators like sales. This is a very popular thing. The other thing is selecting new ideas. You know, here are 200 possible ideas for improving customer experience, for example. Which are the ones that are going to be successful? So you let people bet on those different products, and very quickly you get a ranking of which are collectively estimated to be the good ones. You can also monitor project delivery. This would have been very useful for Airbus and Boeing, for example, right? Who are experiencing incredible delays. Why? Not because the people at the top are stupid or because they are not good managers, but because the information doesn't flow from the factory floor to the CEO. There's just too much loss of information throughout, too many middle managers in between that have no interest in reporting what's actually going on. Okay. And finally, measuring risk, which is, you know, in a globalized world, business has to operate in a very risky environment, in a regulatory ways, for example. So which kind of laws are going to pass that are going to affect our business? What kind of trends are going to completely upstage our business models, or whatever? These are very interesting things to look at. So these prediction markets are actually being used as what we call decision markets. Ways of making better decisions, better informed decisions within those firms. Here's an example of a happy customer, and they don't all look so funny, but this is actually a very serious guy. This is the VP of emerging technologies at Intercontinental Hotels, which is the biggest hotel chain in the world. And so they use prediction markets to figure out new ways of and cheaper ways and faster ways and better ways to improve customer experience. And here's this testimonial. As you can see, he thinks it's much better than just running a poll or hiring Boston Consulting Group to do the same thing. And it's much cheaper, too. So, takeaways. Prediction markets aggregate the insights of many. It's actually their great value is this. It's a fantastic way to aggregate a diverse set of opinions. Prediction markets beat the alternatives, opinion polls, individual experts, official forecasts, and prediction markets are really starting to be used by decision makers within firms and within governments too. For example, some branches of the U.S. Army, local state governments in the U.S. are using this to make forecasts and take decisions. That's it.
So, questions?
I've been following quite regularly the Iowa political market concerning the Democratic primaries. And what it seems to do is that after each primary, people make assessment about the results of the past primaries. For instance, at some point, Hillary Clinton was higher in the real results, so the Iowa prediction market says that she's higher. Then Obama started to go up, and immediately, the day after, the Iowa political market says, well, Obama is going to be up. For instance, if you look then not at the Democratic primaries, but at the competition between the Democrat candidate and the Republican candidate, the prediction of the market is that there is a tie. So I'm not clear about the prediction aspect of this market. Can you clarify more? I mean, I'm just speaking of politics, the only thing I vaguely understand, not about economics.
Yes. It's actually the only thing I've been trading myself. So I can offer the personal trader perspective. This is the Obama stock. Okay. Now, the Obama stock is very interesting. It's been a very eventful season with lots of changes of opinions. What happened? This is Iowa, early January. Okay. Early January, Obama wins Iowa against all odds, elected by a bunch of white guys. So, he was trading not too far. He was trading at, it was 60% for Hillary, 40% for Obama. Big surprise in Iowa. He shoots up very high, and everybody thinks Hillary is dead. And within a week, she's in New Hampshire. All the polls are bad. So, obviously, traders are not stupid. Traders are aggregating information. They're looking at polls, okay? And polls is a major source of information for them. So when the polls in New Hampshire say Clinton is dead, she's going to lose, obviously they are not going to go against local ground data, which is because there's little else they can use, right? So traders believe that, and they go up. But as you can see, it's still only 60%. It's not a huge thing. And of course, so what does that mean? That doesn't mean Obama is going to win. It means 6 chances out of 10 that he's going to win. Not the same thing. So I was actually, did I lose money in New Hampshire? Yes, I did. I did lose a bit of money in New Hampshire because my Obama stock was very high, and then the next day Hillary wins, and as you can see, it falls. Okay, but that's normal. That's the great value of prediction markets, is it gives you immediate feedback of taking into account all the information available. Okay, Now, what happened is that here you go to early March, Super Tuesday. Okay, so they arrive at Super Tuesday, and they're basically, again, trading at 60% for Hillary, 40% for Obama. Okay, so again, she has the advantage. As a trader, I had Obama stock at that point. What do I do? Okay, so I think if Hillary wins in Super Tuesday, Obama is dead. So what do? I dump my Obama stock. I buy Hillary stock because I think, you know, if she beats him, he's worth zero tomorrow. Okay, if it's a tie, then, you know, I buy at 60 Hillary Clinton, and she loses 5 or 10 points because it's a tie. So I don't lose all my money. So to go to sleep, you know, with a peace of mind, as a trader, what I do is I go buy Hillary, so I protect myself, so I can go to sleep, and then the next day, either it's worth 90, what I bought at 60, or it's going to be worth 55, and I lose just a little. Okay, so I take insurance. So these things are used by people like me to hedge against despair, political despair, when your candidate loses, for example, right? Or to hedge against bad political outcomes, which could be extremely stressful when you're political fans, like I am. Okay, so this is a great value of these things. Is not only they can give you the current consensus, and of course the current consensus is going to be changed by events on the ground. Okay, but so is the political discourse you're going to hear on TV by you know, the political pundits. No, if you believe this is bad to look at in terms of information, look at CNN. I mean, look at Fox News. Look at CBS. Look at anything you hear on TV, which is basically worthless opinions. You know? So this is much better than anything you can hear on TV. When everybody before New Hampshire was giving Hillary up for dead, the markets were still telling you there's like 20%. That she's not dead in New Hampshire, okay? And as a trader, when you have to buy that Obama at 80 cents for the dollar, and you're thinking, why is it that there's somebody else there that's willing to sell me that thing? That, you know, what does he know that I don't know that about why Hillary is not dead? Okay, so it gives you a really personal feeling that there is some contrarian information out there that could go the other way. And that contrarian information you don't hear at all in the papers or on TV. Okay, so this is the value of these things.
Thank you. Well, I like the idea of prediction markets, and I think it's very nifty, but I dislike the messianic version of prediction markets, especially applied to politics, because I can see how in a firm prediction markets will ferret out private information. But in terms of these sorts of exercises, I don't see the prediction market ferreting out private information. It's basically tracking the polls and the pundits. And evidence of that is in the 2004 election, when the polls and the pundits said that Bush was going to win. The prediction markets followed that. And then on election day, when there were rumors of the exit polls showing Kerry ahead, on the mere rumors that were reported in the media, the prediction market started calling Kerry. Now, that's not reporting of private information. That's the stampede of the herd. I think the critical test of prediction markets in politics was on the question of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And the prediction markets tracked public opinion, and public opinion was the consequence of the political propaganda of the Bush administration. The private information was there to be ferreted out, and the prediction markets failed to ferret it out. And amazingly, the prediction markets predicted that at a certain point of time, we were more likely to find weapons of mass destruction in the next 2 months than in the next 4 months, which is grossly irrational.
There's no question that when people don't have information, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. There's no question about that.
It wasn't all garbage on WMDs. There were indicators, plenty of indicators.
Well, after the fact, it's easy to say so.
Yes,
possibly. But it doesn't mean that all the people who were who had this information were sufficiently incentivized to get into the market and make money on it. That's a different issue. There's some ethical issues. Lots of people don't feel right betting on their private information about these sorts of things. I mean, if I were Hans Blix, for example, if Hans Blix would have been part of the prediction market, you know, you would have gotten some more interesting information. But I doubt that Hans Blix is a you know, somebody that goes gambling on the internet for some reason. So yes, there is a problem of you know, attracting the right people with sufficiently high monetary incentives as well. You know, there's just not enough money into the current prediction market to really attract and to really encourage deep information digging and deep information exploration. Now, on the other hand, I would strongly disagree that all that prediction markets do for politics is follow the polls, because there are many examples that I've lived through, especially in the French presidential campaign last year, where people, for example, are watching a debate. There was last year a debate between the Nicolas Sarkozy and the socialist candidate against him. And everybody, if you listen to the radio the next morning, or even just after the debate on TV, all the pundits agreed that the socialist had scored points during the debate, because she was very poised. She actually gave him hell, and he looked like on drugs or subdued or whatever, right? But if you looked at the trading on the market during the debate, you could see that Sarkozy was going up. Okay. In complete contradiction to what the polls, to what the pundits were saying the next morning. Okay, everybody agreed she had scored points. And then you had to wait until the end of the day that the first polls came out about the debate performance to see that actually all the pundits had been wrong, and that the people thought that, you know, the TV viewers thought Sarkozy had performed better and improved his chances. Okay. So, yes, when there are polls out there, people will read the polls, and therefore they will integrate that information and use that for their trading, and so it will give the impression they are just following the polls. But when there are no polls, as in this example of the debate, and all they have is their own private impression of what's happening on TV, then they will use that for their trading, and they will precede the polls.
Yeah, I have a question. Taking for granted, for the sake of argument, that these markets are doing very, very well. Just grant that. You said that people are now starting to realize that they should turn to these polls, to these markets instead of the New York Times, which is interesting because the people that are driving the markets are reading the New York Times.
Yes.
Right? So that's interesting. And it raises the question whether you really shouldn't be telling people too much about these markets. Because there seems like there's a well-defined set of analytical questions that could be raised here. What if people start factoring the markets into their inputs? Clearly, if that goes up too high, the market's destroyed. Right? If people say, okay, you know what? I was going to read the New York Times, but now my best source of information is the prediction market. Now, if too many people do that, it's a disaster. It falls apart. So it seems like there's some of this could be done empirically, some of it could be done analytically. Does anybody know of any work along those lines?
So that it just becomes entirely reflexive.
Yeah.
Right.
No. Why not bubbles? Okay, that's interesting because you know you talk about stock markets and immediately the word bubble comes up and oh, these people are crazy and we're happy when it falls on their heads. Why do bubbles happen on the stock market? It's not only that people follow each other. It's also because there's a terrible asymmetry in the structure of what you trade on the stock market. When you take a company stock, it can be worth zero, so it's bounded at the lower limit, but it's unbounded at the higher limit. And for example, the stock of Google can go, you know, stratospherically high. There's no limit to how much Google is going to be worth, right? There's a limit at zero, so you know, there's a bound at one side, there's no bound on the other side. What does that mean? It means that if you want to go against Google, if you think Google is not worth that much, you're taking unbounded risk that the stock could go incredibly high and you're going to lose all your money before you're proved right. Because there's no there's not even proof of being right or wrong on the stock market either, because the stock, the value of the Google stock is supposed to be some kind of weird computation of how much revenue Google is going to make over the next 20 years, okay, which is something nobody can compute. Okay, so it's not tied to any kind of reality, but a prediction market stock is bounded exactly the same way on either side, so there's no asymmetry there. There's no more risk betting down than there is betting up. Okay, on the stock market, there's incredible risk betting down and bounded risk betting up, so everybody bets up, because that's easier to do, it's not as risky. Okay, that's why you get bubbles. I mean, that's one reason bubbles are really horrible on the stock market, and they don't happen as much in prediction markets, because eventually the reality sets in. A real measured outcome is going to be deciding this thing, and there's no more risk either way.
Hi, since you're filling in for Sir Wiki, I thought I would ask you a question I was going to ask him. Of course, if you just think he's wrong on this, you don't have to defend him. Here's my question. In the section on democracy, Sir Wiki just makes the remark that there's no real reason to think that people would be good in every other area, but then suddenly lose their heads in a democratic forum. But then there's this very awkward fact that prediction markets are extremely unpopular for political issues, most notably for the terrorism betting markets case, which my colleague Robin Hanson was closely involved in. So this is a case where when the public found out that there was a proposed plan to bet on terrorism, within one day the program was canceled. Right? So this was an example to throw in the face of everyone who thinks there's a tyranny of the status quo. The political system responded incredibly rapidly to the revelation that a terrorism betting market was being planned by the government. And again, it's no real surprise why, because some of those polls show something like 90% of Americans thought this was about the worst idea that they had ever heard. So here's the real puzzle. If we go and think that the wisdom of crowds applies to democracy, we then see that democracy says we shouldn't be using prediction markets, and that it's wrong and even evil and also useless and dangerous. So I'm curious as to what you might say about that, or what James might say about it if he were here. Either way.
I first answer, then I'll pass them to Emil. I can't answer for James, of course. I can answer for myself. If you think of what Schumpeter said about disruptive innovation, it has to face strong opposition by the masses. So it could be said that people, especially if there were people who were morally opposed to it and said it out loud in the Senate, people would be influenced by this and they would go against something that's new. But I don't think the moral opposition is very much relevant in that case. I'm only speaking for myself. I think, but on the other hand, from a personal point of view, I'm not sure I would be using the decision market for such things. But I...
Well, the program that you're alluding to was canceled, I think, within one day of it being revealed by a couple senators who wanted to get some publicity. So basically, it was canceled before anybody heard about it. Okay. What happened was very interesting. It was great for the industry, of course, because then in the U.S., not here, but in the U.S., everybody talked about this for a week. So you had a week of pundits, opinion writers in all the papers saying this is a really stupid thing. And then you had a couple weeks of everybody else in the academic world coming out and saying, no, wait a minute, this is a fantastic idea. So for the industry, it was a fantastic thing. But I would disagree with your premise that the public opinion was against this from the start, because the public opinion really had no idea what this thing was. They had never heard about it. Until two senators went on the steps of the Capitol Hill and said, this is a horrible thing, it's gambling on death, let's cancel it within the next couple hours, basically. And so they called up the head of the program, Poindexter, fired him publicly, basically on the same day. So public opinion really didn't hear about this at all. So it was just a couple of politicians seeking publicity by canceling this.
Yes, Brian Kaplan from George Mason University. Just a quick follow-up. I'm quite confident the public opinion polls were done, but also the reason why the senators were able to get so much attention is precisely because they knew that this is something that Americans would find was terrible. And again, there was quite a bit of work done afterwards showing that Americans thought this was a bad idea. And I would actually like to stick my neck out and say I am willing to bet and even give some odds that betting markets will not be adopted in the United States on a controversial issue of this kind in the next 20 years. Right. Yes. Okay.
Good. It's related to what you just said. I think that the terrorism future market is not only about moral issue and image. It's important, of course. Some people were shocked by the fact that you would place a bet on death. But it's not only that. I mean, in security circles, there was some concern about who would enter the market, because actually, it's totally plausible that you would have had terrorist groups who would have entered the market and placed a false bet in order to divert the attention of the government. And therefore, you see that this market is not a priori functional. And actually, it raises a sort of a bigger question about the wisdom of crowds. It's about the limits of the crowds. As far as you do not close the border of the group, as far as you go global, such as in this case, well, I think you're pretty much in trouble, because you would find strategies, intentions, and the result will be affected, and you will get exactly the contrary of what you expect.
I don't think so. Personally, I don't think it's because it's international, it's going to be biased, but you're the specialist, so. But I don't see why it would be more biased, because it's international audience.
Well, you raised two questions. One was the design of this particular market, which was, I agree, flawed. I would disagree, though, with your premise that terrorists would have gone to play on this market because it was operated by the DOD. What kind of terrorist would put his credit card to play on something that's operated by the DOD? No, so that was a bit weird. At the same time, you raised the other issue, which is manipulation. Can these things be manipulated to make people think something stupid? And you can see here an example of manipulation, where the stock of Obama goes to zero in July 2007. Okay, what happens there? And your colleague at George Mason, Robin Hanson, which is a genius, and I have profound admiration for him. He changed my life. It's because of him that I started doing this. Robin Hanson showed in the lab, and we see that regularly in real prediction markets, that whenever somebody tries to manipulate the stock by moving it to a price that is apparently stupid to most people, that just makes the market even more efficient, because it creates incentives for people who do have the right information to get in and bet against the somebody who's behaving stupidly. Okay, and in fact, you don't have a market unless you have people behaving stupidly to some extent. I mean, you have to have a way to make money from people who know less than you. So when somebody tries to manipulate the thing, it just makes the market even more efficient. And all kinds of manipulation are just immediately corrected, as you can see here. They get immediately corrected with lots of people making lots of money because somebody behaves stupidly.
2 points. First, what is the evidence that the greater the brain activity, the better the performance from an epistemic point of view in general? Right? Because you gave that as one argument, therefore I assume from cognitive neuroscience to trust these markets to a greater degree. Can you go back to the... Or maybe answer to the Obama thing. So the other point is, when you have a value here, what's the interpretation? Is it that on that day when you have, say, 60%, there's a 60% chance on that day that Obama will win the nomination? That's not, it's not an easy interpretation, first because the probability of a future event, single future event, is not a well-defined notion. You might say still it's an from a Bayesian point of view, it might be the optimal bet, but you yourself gave us reason to doubt that, because in fact, you're betting not on that day, on what will happen on the day of nomination, but what will happen the next day, the value of the future. So, you know, you describe what you did yourself, and that gave me a reason to doubt that even if you are from a Bayesian point of view optimizing, you're optimizing the value of the future the next day and not the probability of Obama getting the nomination.
Right. The thing is, there's no... It's not important what I do as an individual trader. What we describe in terms of calibration, like this.
That's just before the match. And it's a series of events, fairly repetitive, rather than...
Well, that's why, I mean, you cannot judge the probability assessment for a single event. That's why we run that on, you know, hundreds of events, like inside Google or in the sports or whatever. So what I do as a trader is not necessarily rational. It's not driven by probability assessments, okay? It's just the emergent property of the market with lots of people like me making assessments which are not probability or rational driven that emerges to be rational and to reflect the true probability, as we can see in those calibration examples, which are work in movies, they work in politics, they work everywhere. Okay, so if you take enough of these events. So it also means that, yes, on any day, you can take these predictions with a grain of salt, okay? Because they do change from 20% to 80% over the course of the primary, okay? What it means is that, but if you take the probability assessment on any day of this thing, and you take all the other probability assessments for all the other candidates on the same day, you get, again, a sample of prices which will be calibrated.
On the brain?
Oh, on the brain thing. So, no, there's no saying that the brain, the more active areas there are in the brain and the smarter you are is stupid, of course, right? I mean, that's not what I'm saying. And what I was showing here is that there are specific areas of the brain that get actually increasingly activated or deactivated. Actually, those things get more activated when you consider reward and deactivated when you consider loss, okay? And they get proportionally activated or deactivated to the size of the reward or the loss. Okay, I'm just showing that there are different areas of the brain that get involved when you consider a bet and when you're just answering a poll. That's all.
Great, that'll be it for this session. Thank you to both our panelists.